You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is someday in either February or March. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live-ish in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what day it is. I'm not even 100% sure what month it is. Could be March. Could be February. Probably March. So what am I doing here? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not here. We have pre-recorded this intro in the event that, well, not in the event, for when the inevitable event of the birth of my second child takes place. And because you're hearing it, it means that I am on paternity leave. How long will it be? Probably not that long. I may take a little more time later, but for the next day or two or three or four, maybe five, depending on which day you're listening to this, we will have a series of either guest hosts or pre-recorded interviews that we've done, or archive shows. And in just a moment, you will hear the dulcet tones of Matt and Michael, the Majority Report producers, who will explain whether it's a guest host or some archived interviews from the first Majority Report or from this version of the Majority Report, or interviews that I pre-recorded over the past couple of weeks, or interviews done by some of my friends. Not to say that Michael and Matt aren't my friends. I'm friendly with them. But let's not get carried away. So I leave it now to Matt and Michael to give you the information. They'll tell you what the date is. They'll tell you what the status is of the birth of my second child. And they'll let you know what to expect on today's program. So see you soon.
It is Wednesday, March 13th. I'm Michael Brooks.
And I am Matt Binder. Here we go.
Here we go. We got Toots of the Maytales behind us, folks. Another goal accomplished.
Yes.
During Sam's paternity
leave. It's like dueling pressure drops.
Dueling pressure drops. I know which one is better. Obviously, the Toots and the Maytales one.
Well, can't defy the clash.
I think I just did, my friend.
I think you just did, Ben. You're wrong for doing so.
Well, so wrong it's right, man. There's no more real news to share about the baby, folks. He's healthy.
He's healthy. His name is Saul. Mila probably isn't too happy that all the attention is going towards the baby right now.
I think Mila's fine. Mila's great. Everything sounds good. We actually talked with Sam yesterday. Everything seems to be sailing well in the Cedar ship. He seemed friendly to us on the phone yesterday.
Friendly, yes, friendly. Like you mentioned in the opening. Friendly,
yeah,
not
friendly.
Friends.
We had a very civil and professional conversation with him yesterday. I think it went well yesterday
with
Tina.
It was more like we were acquaintances yesterday than friends.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Of course. Obviously. On today's show, we've got a lot of good things for you. We have an interview with Christopher Petrella, which I recorded a couple of weeks ago Chris is actually an old friend of mine back from college days, and he is a journalist and a PhD student, and he's doing a lot of work on exposing the private prison industry.
Michael likes to brag.
I'm bragging about my friend.
You're bragging.
It's called an introduction. Wouldn't it be funny if we all introductions just like, yeah, later on we have Elliot Spitzer. I'm not going to say what he did, you know.
If you were friends with Elliot Spitzer, that would be pretty cool.
Oh, really?
Yes, that would be something to brag about.
Prison reform advocate. All right, folks.
I think we should
get briefly off of the top. Brief thing I want to go over. Yesterday, I'm going to bring the music down.
Sure, let's do it.
Yesterday, President Obama was on George Stephanopoulos' show. And he responded to Paul Ryan's new budget, which is just a horror show. We'll go over it later in the show. And I liked his response because not only did he rule out the extremes of in the Ryan budget, but again, just like with Pelosi the other day, I like a very much how President Obama framed this. So I think we have sound for that. I just want to play the sound.
I understand, which is why at some point I think I take myself out of this. Right now what I'm trying to do is create an atmosphere where Democrats and Republicans can go ahead, get together, and try to get something done. But ultimately it may be that the differences are just too wide. If their position is we can't do any revenue, or we can only do revenue if we gut Medicare or gut Social Security or gut Medicaid, if that's the position, then we're probably not going to be able to get a deal.
Yeah, I think that that's really good. I think that the fact that he's starting to publicly acknowledge some red lines in terms of where he will and won't go potentially, and also framing it that we don't just want a deal for deal's sake. I think that that's really fundamentally important because we've been playing in this terrain where there's just this obsession to make a deal, almost like to, you know, complete a story cycle on some, you know, bad CBS procedural drama or something. And we're not talking about the substance. And I think him stepping back and saying, we're not going to just cut a deal for the sake of the deal is very positive. I think also because a criticism of some people have had of President Obama is that he is obsessed with the deal making almost regardless of the consequences at certain points. So there's still some things that he's entertaining that I don't like that we'll get into later, but I think that this was a good step.
I agree. I mean, again, we've heard it before, and then right. He comes out and pitches things like chain CPI and.
Right. No, that's a totally fair.
I just don't know what to say about him on this anymore.
That's a fair point, and he is actually we'll get to the chain CPI thing later, folks. We're gonna take a brief break. I'm gonna come back. We're gonna have an interview with my friend that I've just been shamelessly bragging about, Christopher Petrella, on the private prison industry. This was recorded also a couple of weeks ago. So again, we were talking about a story that was in the headlines about a private prison company sponsoring a football stadium in Florida.
And unfortunately, just yesterday it was announced that there's no more private prisons. They're just ending. The industry is over.
That's right.
So this interview is a little bit out of date.
It's a little bit out of date.
Obviously, it's not. It doesn't matter when this was recorded because this is just as important now as it was last week whenever you recorded it.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So anyways, folks, we'll be back with that in just a few seconds. No, not ever. I don't want to be right. Hood stars, we are. Yeah. Dickie, Ding, and Terry's. Carhartt, Congress, fitted hat, high rank of fish out. World Bank like Rothschilds. Take the wool from over your eyes. Who conspires to deceive you and I? It's easy for a man to believe a big lie. Then a small truth. Money's not evil. It's the love of money. That's the root. Not a luxury car worshiper, but I purchase particular vehicles. So me and my dudes, we could cruise. Upsetting policia. He creeps to study my natural sleepy eye to see if I'm high. I got my piece of the pie. My 40 acres is my 40 carats on my. And now that interview with Christopher Petrella on the private prison industry. Hi, I'm Michael Brooks, filling in for Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. And with me now is Christopher Petrella. He is a journalist. He's a PhD candidate at University of California, Berkeley. And he's the co-director of a campaign to bring transparency to the private prison industry. He's also a pretty long-term friend of mine, so I'm happy to be talking with him. How are you doing, Chris?
Great, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So just give us a sense of the private prison industry. How much of the prison market is private? How many U.S. prisoners are held in private prisons? Just give us a sense of what kind of a market share we're talking about here.
Sure. So it's a great introductory question. I would say that at the present moment, about 10% of all prisons in the United States are contract-operated facilities, that being privatized corrections facilities. Private prison companies control approximately 10% of the market, which includes about 130,000 beds in the United States.
That's a pretty stunning number, when you contextualize it. Getting more into the specifics, are there racial disparities even relative to the rest of the prison population, which I assume that there are racial disparities to begin with, but are there even heightened racial disparities in private prisons?
There are. Actually, my colleague Josh Begley at NYU and I just completed a report in which we looked at select state departments of corrections in California, Texas, and Arizona. And we found that in these states, persons of color are overrepresented in private facilities contracting with these states by about 15% relative to their already overrepresentation in public prisons based on the population share of that particular state. So it calls into question the relationship of racialized forms of punishment, profit extraction from bodies of color, and contemporary forms of containment.
Okay, so that's 50. I just want to think that's a real strong statistic to highlight. That's 15% on top of already pretty significant disparities in imprisonment, even relative to the kind of the convention or state-run prison population. That's pretty stunning. So do these companies, these are modern corporations, do they have diversified portfolios? meaning, do they work in other sectors? Are they running detention facilities for other types of populations that we might not necessarily think of being detained but are being detained?
Right, that's right. So actually, it's fascinating because when you begin to disaggregate the data, we find that although only between 9 and 10% of public facilities are currently privatized, when the unit of analysis becomes detention centers, migrant or immigrant detention centers, we actually find that about 50% of that quote-unquote market is privatized, and the two leading publicly traded for-profit private prison companies in the United States, CCA and GEO Group, actually have about 50 to 55% of immigrant detention facilities cornered in the United States today. And this is a vast, vast increase from rates of privatized detention facilities over the past 10 years or so. So I think it's also important to think about rates of change and rates of growth. And though, for example, only 10%, but this is still a stunning statistic, 10% of prisons are privatized in the United States today, the number of those behind bars in privatized facilities has ballooned by about 1,600% since 1990. So institutionally, this is a very, very recent type of intervention, although one of the claims that Josh and I are making in our study between race and prison privatization is that there are severe historical precedents that have already been set forth vis-a-vis race and prison privatization.
Okay, yeah, and I would love if you could jump into that a little bit more in a moment. But first, just to be clear, and the types of undocumented immigrants we're talking about, I'm assuming these are people who maybe were here working, say, at a meat packing plant or a slaughterhouse or something like that, undocumented workers. They're rounded up in some type of federal raid, and they're held in one of these detention facilities, essentially with little to no kind of formal rights or process until they're deported. Is that what we're talking about here?
That's right. No, you're absolutely right, Michael. So the, you know, I would say about a month ago, the Migration Policy Institute released a report finding that the budget for ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ballooned by around 90% since 2005. And this is mostly a direct result of what's colloquially known as Operation Streamline, essentially a policy that forces undocumented migrants through the federal criminal justice system and into U.S. detention facilities instead of routing nonviolent individuals caught, quote, crossing the border into civil deportation proceedings, which had been done previous to 2005. And so the result of which is that last year alone, over 400,000 detainees passed through the federal immigration system. And as I mentioned before, this is a system in which slightly over 50% of all detention facilities are contracted to for-profit private companies. And I should add that that most of these private companies, the largest, in fact, of these private companies, are actually publicly traded. You can buy shares of these stocks.
Well, I do. I'm a smart investor, Chris. So, no, I'm just kidding.
That's right.
I'm just kidding.
That's right.
Yeah. So, what is the largest stock? What is the name of the largest company?
The largest company is Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA.
Okay.
They're a Nashville-based firm. They control about 44% of the entire corrections market. And the second largest publicly traded company is the GEO Group. They're based in Boca Raton, Florida. And they control slightly over 30% of the market. So these two companies alone control close to 75% of the privatized corrections market, which is a pretty striking indictment against arguments of competition. Right?
Right. We're talking about a real duopoly market here. Now, getting into the
you have a
recent piece out. I'm just going to look down for a second to make sure I have this the full name here. And I think this will get into some of the most kind of interesting and disturbing things that are happening now and some of the historical precedents that you mentioned before. The new piece you have in Truth Out, I think it is in, is The Legacy of Chattel Slavery, Private Prisons Blur the Line Between Real People and Real Estate. And basically what you reported in this piece is that CCA, which is the largest private prison company, and I think GEO as well wants to do this, but I know CCA does, they are petitioning the IRS to get a change in their tax standing so that they're recognized as a real estate company. Now, can you explain a little bit of the specifics of why they would want to do that, what that actually means, and what the implications are for the people that they're detaining if they actually succeeded in getting that reclassification?
That's right. So I think the piece was published maybe two weeks ago or so, and I primarily concentrated on the dealings of the GEO Group, although you're right, Mike, to say that CCA also requested a private letter ruling from the IRS and actually achieved one just last week. So both of these companies have converted themselves retroactive to January 1 to real estate investment trusts from traditional Class C corporations. Now, what does this mean is the $3 million question. Essentially, a REIT is an entity that distributes at least 90% of its taxable income to shareholders every year in the form of dividends. And in exchange, companies classified as REITs with the IRS receive a zero federal and often state corporate tax liability. So, for example, GEO estimated that it would save about $50 million on an annual basis through this REIT conversion. And some of the criteria that need to be met in order to receive a private letter ruling from the IRS is that a company needs to invest at least 75% of its total assets in real estate and derive at least 95% of its gross income from real estate related sources. And so in the most recent investor presentation by the Geo Group, they claim that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but they claim, you know, fundamentally the Geo Group is a real estate intensive industry. They go on to say that the Geo Group has very attractive real estate characteristics. And so I think in a lot of ways, right, the way they're stylizing themselves here, lobbying for and achieving this status with the IRS, I mean, shows in pretty, unimpeachable terms that the Geo Group, by and large, and primarily sees itself as a real estate firm that incidentally dabbles in corrections, not an agency whose primary objective or mission is the reduction of recidivism, community restoration, rehabilitation, public safety, et cetera. Choose your mission. So this conversion and new designation with the IRS, I think, begs some other questions about the types of bodies that are being contained in prisons that are run by these companies, real estate intensive companies.
Well, right, because what we're literally talking about here is exactly everything you identified. I mean, you know, there's a couple of different steps to this. It's advantageous from a business perspective to do this. It shows that their core mission obviously isn't theoretically what it should be, which is reducing recidivism, rehabilitation. But then third, we've already talked about the racial disparities here, and now you're talking about companies that hold prisoners of color in very disparate numbers, basically saying we're real estate firms. I mean, so that's that I think echoes some extremely troubling precedents and ways of looking at people that you were highlighting in your piece. And it's just really disturbing to see it kind of reemerge in this ultra modern kind of context of, you know, publicly traded sort of rational business decisions. But the implications are really disturbing and really unsettling along with everything else. So actually, I think this is sort of moves into this kind of final thread that I wanted to touch with you before we could get to hopefully what we could actually do about bringing some accountability to this, which is, you know, in recent weeks or in the past month or so, there have been these two very funny ways that both of these companies, both of the two main companies, Geo and CCA, have kind of emerged in a more public way. So these are powerful companies that are publicly traded. But maybe in the past, it didn't seem like necessarily they were doing that much work to kind of build their public brand. Two things recently seems to kind of indicate that maybe they're starting to think about that. Now, CCA's CEO, back in January, put out a press release commemorating Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So that's pretty astonishing, and I want you to, you know, comment on that. There's a lot of, there are a lot of ironies. It's unintended, intended. And then secondly, and this broke more recently, that Geo is going to be sponsoring a football stadium at a state university in Florida, and they will actually have their name on the stadium as a private prison company. Now, I want you to talk maybe briefly just about both of those instances and get your thoughts on them. But I'm also curious, do you think that there is a strategic shift in how these companies are approaching interfacing with the public and how they want to be perceived from a brand perspective and, you know, potentially just even normalized in a certain sense as just another player in the world of business to kind of be respected and sponsor football games and honor American political icons.
That's right. Well, so those are both fascinating stories and perceptive questions, Mike. So I think I'll try to take them in reverse order.
Go for it.
But as you mentioned, the Geo Group, which again is the second largest publicly traded private prison firm in the country, just yesterday announced its intention to gift, I believe it was $6 million over a 12-year period to Florida Atlantic University, which happens to be a public institution located less than 5 miles from GEO's corporate headquarters in Boca Raton, Florida. And in exchange for this, Florida Atlantic University has agreed to slap the words GEO Group Stadium on its football facility. What's fascinating about this to me, Mike, what's actually most fascinating about this to me, and I know you did a piece yesterday on this for Russia Today, is that the rhetorical strategy that spokespeople for the GEO Group have utilized in justifying these incursions into sort of a more cultural landscape, I'd say, mm-hmm. have been shot through with the rhetoric of corporate citizenship, right? What does it mean to be a good corporate citizen? And what I think is particularly ironic and worth noting often here is that despite praising its commitment to corporate citizenship, GEO's recent conversion to a real estate investment trust, right, one which reduces its corporate tax liability to zero and thereby deprives public agencies of tax bases they need, right, demonstrates itself the bankruptcy of the concept of corporate citizenship, right? If you're a company and you truly care about being a corporate citizen, which of course the language around this is suspect to begin with, then I can think of no better way than pulling your weight by paying your fair share of taxes, right, to the state, to the federal government, to make sure that we don't continue to see this creeping sort of disinvestment in public services, public institutions, public agencies, much like UC Berkeley, which is where I'm a student now. I mean, it's a public university in name only. I mean, we receive less than 10% of the operating budget every year from public sources, from taxpayer dollars in California. That's the first response. The second with CCA is just to highlight the sort of egregious irony in Damon Hininger drafting a press release illustrating the ways in which the company is celebrating Black History Month. And I think this sort of brings us right back to sort of the legacy of Dr. King, who drafted obviously a very famous letter from the Birmingham jail, in which he in part denounced the specific types of racialized punishment. And more broadly, the types of sort of punishment that are applied to folk who are agitating politically against sort of traditional and normative status quo institutions. And so I'll just say this to sort of bring this portion to a close. This is why it's particularly important always when thinking about prison privatization in the United States in particular to introduce and reintroduce time and again questions of race as one of the units of analysis. It's overlooked. It's a marginalized type of discourse, and that's one of the things that I and a lot of other people are trying to do these days.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. So that's a lot. There's a lot here. There's a lot at stake, obviously. Now, you're the co-chair or co-directing a campaign to at least start to bring some more transparency to this, because I think that this is an issue that potentially, actually, with the football stadium issue, it might get on more people's radar, but it was not on many people's radar before. What are the sort of best steps? What are you guys pushing for in your campaign? What needs to happen to try to bring some oversight and hopefully some genuine reform to this issue?
Right. Okay. So as you essentially introduced the topic, so I, along with Alex Friedman of Prison Legal News, are directing a campaign with a coalition of, at this point, over 50 not-for-profit criminal justice and public interest organizations urging Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee out of Texas to reintroduce what's called the Private Prison Information Act during this congressional session. And the bill if enacted, would extend Freedom of Information Act, also known as FOIA, reporting obligations to private corrections firms that contract with federal agencies. And so our sense is this is the first important step in bringing transparency and accountability to the private prison industry, because if citizens and policymakers alike are in a position to adjudicate the merits of public versus private corrections facilities, then we need to have all of the information at our disposal in order to make any comparison of an equivalence or any equivalent comparison. And we currently can't do that because the private prison industry is shrouded in a veil of secrecy. They claim that according to, I believe it's the fourth exemption under the Freedom of Information Act, they do not have to report basically any information pertaining to their operations because it says it would violate their proprietary interests under the Freedom of Information Act exemption. And so we're trying to change that through a legislative channel right now, and we have a lot of excellent organizations on board where the act has not yet been reintroduced, but we are very hopeful that over the next few weeks, we'll have some good news.
Yeah, and there's a lot of momentum behind this. I mean, your work has been featured by Andrew Sullivan and Fortune Magazine. There's a lot of really big organizations pushing for this. And I mean, you know, why on earth would these companies have any obligation to share their information when all of their profit base comes from public contracts? I mean, it just seems ludicrous on its face. It's sort of take the public contracts, hide the information, and then become a real estate holding company so you don't have to pay any taxes to wash back for your next contracts. I mean, it's kind of just I don't know how all those things are squared, but I know that it has something to do with admiring Dr. King and liking football.
That's right. It is stranger than fiction, Michael.
Yeah. Stranger than fiction, but really incredibly important and really incredibly disturbing. And I thank you for your work, man. And that's Christopher Petrella. He's a journalist. He's a PhD candidate at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's co-director of a campaign to bring accountability to the private prison industry. As I said before, also a good friend. Great talking with you, Chris, and I'll talk to you soon, man.
Thanks, Mike. Keep up the good work.
Welcome back, folks. That was my interview with Christopher Petrella, and we'll put some links up on the site for both the campaign that's working around those issues and some other links, particularly for that bill that they're pushing for Sheila Jackson Lee to reintroduce in Congress. It was a really important issue. I felt like just really disturbing stuff, which hopefully we'll get.
It was a great
attention.
Interview. It really was. It was good stuff.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
It's amazing what goes on. I mean, just unbelievable.
No, it really is just fundamentally unbelievable. And speaking of kind of fundamentally unbelievable, Paul Ryan released a new budget yesterday, and
I think that should be his tagline, like Paul fundamentally unbelievable Ryan.
Paul fundamentally unbelievable, incredible sociopath who looks like Alfalfa Ryan.
Not as concise as
not
mine,
as concise.
But
no, yours was better. It's more concise. But I do like the sociopath who looks like Alfalfa, who wants to take away your Medicare, Ryan. Yesterday,
Tina Dupuy
did an excellent job, sort of breaking down the numbers in the budget, and the new sort of study from the Heritage Foundation, which just reiterates all of their previous fake numbers from the Bush administration when they scored out his tax cuts. So if, obviously those tax cuts worked out incredibly well, so we can have confidence that Ryan's budget will work out incredibly
well. And by
well.
Incredibly well, Michael means the exact opposite.
Means basically it destroyed the entire planet, basically the fiscal health of the United States for a generation. She did that on the better half of the show, and you can look that up on YouTube and take a look at it. She did a great job describing it. But I want to kind of come back for a second to the Ryan budget. For a couple of different reasons. One is I think that there's just this fundamentally delusional quality here because he's proposing, if anything, an even more extreme budget than he had proposed before. And I think that what's fascinating to me is I remember in 2009, some people on the right said, and actually even on the left, I had this perspective on the left in some ways. I thought not only would it be easier, I mean, I actually always thought Mitt Romney would be pretty easy to beat. But I thought, you know, not only would it be easier, I mean, if they actually nominated someone they wouldn't nominate, but if they actually nominated a Gingrich or a Santorum or something, not only would Obama win in a landslide, but there would be no way that the right could say that this candidate wasn't pure enough, or Mitt Romney's a flip-flopper, or Mitt Romney's really a moderate, or all the rest. And I think that there was a concern that there wasn't going to be this real test of extreme right-wing ideas with Romney getting the nomination. But I'll tell you, when he picked Paul Ryan and he ran the campaign he chose to run, that was a test of far right-wing politics today. That was a test of doubling down on all of the most extreme trickle-down ideas of George W. Bush. It was a double down on tax policy. It was a double down on slashing, gutting, fundamentally decimating the modern social, not only safety net, but just really modern social infrastructure that we all rely on. And they lost. They lost badly. And President Obama, certainly rhetorically, made that choice very clear. Joe Biden made that choice very clear in his debate with Paul Ryan, the vice presidential debate. So that election happened. It was done. The result was clear. Paul Ryan actually said in his press conference yesterday that we ran on and arguably won on some of these ideas. Now, I don't know what planet or what universe or what kind
of – Did he specify or he just said some of these ideas?
He said that he has a computer-generated Dungeons & Dragons game that he plays with the Koch brothers, and those ideas won in their fantasy universe that they're playing in together. But obviously nothing involving real life. Now, and I think what's amazing about this, and I want to quote Jonathan Cohn, who writes for The New Republic, and he basically said this. He said, Ryan's budget that he outlined yesterday would be analogous to quote, Walter Mondale returning to Congress in 1985 and proposing a budget that undid President Reagan's agenda, reduced deficits by raising taxes on the middle class, and in other words, the exact same thing he'd proposed in his losing campaign for the presidency. So, and as we remember, Walter Mondale lost, I believe that was actually 49 states to one. He lost a very convincing that was a very convincing loss. It was probably if Sam was old enough to vote, it was probably Sam Cedar voting for Walter Mondale, my parents, and probably the audience of this show. That was probably basically it. But I think it's really interesting he brought up that example because it shows where the Republicans are at now in terms of their effort to rebrand and change, which is to say there is no effort. Now, the Democrats in the 1980s, and I think a lot of people that listen to the show probably don't like the changes that the Democrats implemented. There were a lot of really fundamentally problematic changes. But people like Bill Clinton, like Al Gore, and other people who were associated with something called the Democratic Leadership Council and this whole notion of third-way politics sat down and they really tried to figure out why are we losing elections. And part of it, and the part of it that's remained is – let's be more pro-business. Let's raise more corporate sector money. There's no doubt about it. The other part of it was they went to a county, I think it was Macomb County in Michigan, which became the standout of white working class voters that switched from the Democrats to vote for Reagan. These are the original Reagan Democrats. And Stanley Greenberg, who's a Democratic pollster and strategist, still working today, he went and he did focus groups with these voters and he asked them, why are you not voting for Democrats anymore? And, you know, some of it was very disturbing. There was definitely some racism there that was pretty blunt and direct. There was some real social conservatism. But there was also this sense that Democrats were not respectful and mindful of their social concerns and not kind of focusing like a real laser beam on their economic concerns in some respects. And if you remember when President Clinton first ran for president in 1992, that was the first sort of third way campaign. And he moved to the right on economic and social issues, but he also talked about putting people first. He talked about universal health care. He talked about if you work hard and play by the rules, you should be able to succeed and do well in this economy. So in some ways, he actually made a really kind of broader and clearer populist argument because it wasn't differentiated by group by group. So he was speaking to a broader American middle class and working class audience. That's the kind of genesis of the third way, and that spread. You know, Tony Blair rebranded the Labour Party using the same political strategies and techniques. They won in Britain. And look, it was very politically effective, I think, and obviously in a lot of ways there's some really problematic aspects of this legacy that we still live with. Part of what we still live with is that Democrats occupy the center and also arguably the center right, and Republicans are just on the extremes, now on the extreme right. Now, that might be good for us from an electoral point of view, but I don't know how good that is actually for progressives, because it leaves all of this vacuum and all of this space in terms of pushing a policy. Because if you basically have the center and then the extreme right, what are we going to do?
Exactly.
Right? And I think that that's the kind of dynamic that comes up a lot on the show every day. And actually, in some ways, that's why we should be hoping that some Republicans will actually sit down and potentially get serious about trying to reoccupy the center ground a little bit so that that space has a little bit more competition, and potentially that might open more space in on
the. It might force some Democrats to move further to the left.
It might force some Democrats to move further to the left. Now, I think in some ways I think the makeup of this Senate is a little bit further to the left than it was previously, and this sort of all comes together.
But that's
here.
Not saying much.
It's definitely not saying much, exactly. So I think it all comes together here, though, when you look at – and I love what President Obama said in his interview with Stephanopoulos. But by that same token, as with these things, kind of like Matt said, with President Obama, with one hand one hand gives, one hand takes away, he was on Capitol Hill pushing apparently the idea of a chain CPI, which is a Social Security cut, to Senate Democrats again. And that I would say those are the vestiges – of that sort of third way politics, frankly. And he got, apparently he got very strong pushback against chain CPI from Senate Democrats like Tom Harkin, a couple of others.
Bernie Sanders.
Obviously Bernie Sanders is great on these issues. And Elizabeth Warren said in an interview last week, and I think this distills it, chain CPI is just a fancy way to say a cut in benefit for seniors, the permanently disabled, and orphans. And then as this article in Salon by Alex Zeitzwald says, on top of it, President Obama, he gets pushback from Democrats, and he's still not going to get any credit from Republicans for proposing these things. So the conclusion of this sort of riff is the Republicans are completely delusional and crazy. That may not be a great thing for long-term progressive politics, because I think we actually want more legitimate competition in the center ground, because as long as the kind of people like President Obama are defining the center by sort of how much we cut, how much we tinker versus how much we invest, how much we innovate, and how much we provide for people real opportunity and real mobility, which is what I think progressive politics is about, that's really problematic. But anyways, folks, thank you so much. I think we're going to be heading into the better half of the show.
Wow, the show's done already. Look at that. Well, the first half of the show is done. Now the lesser half of the show is done.
Matt is going to take the reins for the better half of the show with your calls, IMs, a story that I guess, again, is just unbelievable.
Unbelievable. I think there's two stories here that are unbelievable. So which one are you talking about?
I'm thinking of the LAPD story.
The LAPD one is probably at the top of the unbelievable pyramid.
It's at the top. This is a very unbelievable show with the private prisons and everything else. But listen, folks, we say this every day, and it's really true. Become a member.
Please.
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 Yeah. I feel like Obama really, at the State of the Union. And you should become a member now.
Oh, here we go. Mr. Brooks here. He's been getting so much positive feedback.
I know, I just got to give
for
a
his Obama impersonation yesterday.
Sam has a new
baby. It was very good.
And that's why you should become a member now. And if you can afford it, become a Cedarista. We can fund the Majority Report sustainably into the future. I know we can do this. All right. I'm having too much fun. But seriously, folks, become a member.
646-257-3920 is the number to call in for you members or live listeners out there. Libertarians, we'd like you to call in too.
Very much.
You can IM us on the – you know the IM is there on the contact page on the website. I can't think right now. Donate your account at donateyouraccount.com. You could donate both your Twitter and Facebook account. You could like us on Facebook at facebook.com/majorityreport. You can follow us on Twitter at Majority FM. Follow Michael Brooks at underscore Michael Brooks.
I was late to the Twitter game, folks.
Help him out. He's late to the Twitter game.
I don't have many Twitter followers. Follow at Matt Binder, who is a friggin' Twitter master. And look at Matt Binder's shame, public shame blog.
Thank you. That's
that is amazing. I mean, it will make you sick.
That's at publicshaming.tumblr.com.
It's actually amazing. It's pretty astonishing to see what people actually write. So we're going to go into the better half. Become a member, give us a call, and we're going to make the switch now, I believe.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.